have our next guest is Dina McLeod. McLeod. She's a medical peer review publication expert, and she's the principal and founder of Kaleidoscope Strategic, an independent media medical research firm that supports Canadian clinicians in preparing world-class evidence-based reviews that advance patient care nationally and internationally. And she's also the chair of the Strategic Advisory Committee at Canadian COVID Care Alliance. Yeah, it's great that you're here with us today. And you've done done some important work, I think, on like reviewing what's going on with the vaccination, the injection stuff, basically.
And you've taken a closer look at the Pfizer trials, right?
Yes, we've definitely taken a deep dive into the Pfizer data. One of the things that our organization has been doing in the area of cancer research for over 20 years, we've written about 40 peer-reviewed guidelines in treatment reviews in cancer. Mm-hmm. And so what our group specializes in, we've got a group of PhDs and MDs in molecular oncology, pathophysiology, clinical oncology. And what we love to do is take a look at data, analyze studies, and try and figure out, what you can and can't say and what is and isn't supported in terms of proof for a given guideline or treatment. And so, of course, we felt that it was very important, when this pandemic occurred and when vaccines were being presented as the main way to get through a pandemic, to take a careful look at the data and to scrutinize it to see if it is saying exactly what the messaging that we've been told it has been saying, like whether the data actually supports the messaging. And so that's when our group took a deep dive. We've been working in collaboration with the Canadian COVID Care Alliance, which is a fantastic group, a very diverse group of experts with, expertise in immunology, testing, virology, vaccinology. So it's been a real privilege to be working really closely with them. And that's when our organization worked with the CCCA to develop the 6-month video, which I believe you guys have seen, and which I'd love to walk through with you today and answer any of the questions that you have.
Yes.
Yeah. So would you like me to present the data, and how long would you like to spend going over that versus just chatting about the findings? And would you like to talk about it interactively, or would you like to kind of run through it and then chat at the end?
How long is your presentation if you just do it?
It's about 30 minutes.
Yeah, that's perfect.
I think that's good because
let's just play it by ear. Walk us through the presentation and maybe we can ask questions if they come up.
Yeah, if you have questions when they come up, maybe we'll just kind of pause and I'll expand upon it. Because if you're not used to clinical data, you might have questions, or your viewers might have questions. And so, that might be a good way to do it. So,
we have our clinical expert Wolfgang with us. So he's going to be able to answer our questions.
Yeah. All right. Well, between the two of us, we'll take a look at it. So let me just queue up my presentation. Do I have screen sharing capabilities here?
Yeah.
Okay. Desktop. There we go. Just let me know when you can see my slide presentation and I'll queue it up.
And by the way, like while we were speaking to Professor Desmet, another of our streams got shut down.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. I mean, talking of paranoia.
Yeah, this is we're dealing with. Professor Desmet is the perfect expert on paranoia, and we're seeing it on the other side. They're panicking. That's why I still think that we're on the right track, and that's why I still think, and even more so, that there's all the more reason to be very optimistic about what's developing right now. But please go ahead.
Yeah, so this is our presentation, and it's called More Harm Than Good. I've already mentioned that I'm Deanna. You've done a wonderful introduction. And so we're part of the Canadian COVID Care Alliance, which has 500 independent Canadian doctors, scientists, and health practitioners. And we work collaboratively in Canada to look through the evidence and to see whether some of the guidance that we're receiving in Canada is sufficiently supported by data, and also to do our very best to get good data out to Canadians so that they can make informed choices. And some of the things that our organization is passionate about are the doctor-patient relationship and personalized care. And I'm just going to pause for a moment and talk about personalized care, mm-hmm. coming from my area of expertise, which is clinical oncology. We've been working in the area of cancer, and what we pride ourselves in is understanding a patient's clinical history, clinical biomarkers, what's driving their cancers, and taking numerous treatments and tailoring them to the personal situation that they have. So basically, personalized care means customizing a treatment based on your particular profile. And it's very fascinating that at a time when there's levels of sophistication in medicine that have never had that have never been achieved in previous times, that we've turned around and decided that there's just one treatment that should be applied to every single person in the globe. And that is the only way forward out of a pandemic or a complex medical problem. And just basic knowledge of human physiology and diversity, we all know that it is very unlikely that one treatment can be beneficial or safe for everybody. And so that's one of the things that we find very fascinating, just from a principled position on the approach taken. And that makes us pause and look more carefully at the data to see if it is possible that one thing could actually solve a problem, the medical problem of an entire globe. So we're really passionate about informed consent. And informed consent, by definition, means that you're given all the information about a treatment, the risks and the benefits, and that you're given treatment alternatives if they're available, including no treatment. And again, that seems to be something that we've decided to put aside during this pandemic. And our messaging is very clear. And at least in Canada here, we are having people, there's mandates for vaccination, and we're not even being offered. Many times people aren't even giving medical exemptions. Even if the study that was used to support and approve this agent weren't even included. So, for instance, a good example of that is pregnant women. Mm-hmm. So we believe in free and open scientific discourse. So we're here presenting our data. If you have any questions, if you have any challenges to us, we'd love to be able to discuss those with you. We think that scientific discourse is the key to discovery, and it always has been, debate and the exchange of ideas and refining ideas together. And of course, we believe in safe and effective therapies, and specifically that includes vaccines. So when we look at data, we want to be relying on the highest level of evidence. Many of the policies that have been taken place often rely, or at least the guidance for lockdowns, for instance, relies on real world data where we're tracking cases in a population. And if they're going up and going down, then we make decisions about that, whether our hospitals are filling up or whether our hospitals aren't filling up, then we make decisions. But those uncontrolled studies or observational studies are low level evidence, and they can be easily confounded. And so when we want to understand what's happening with a vaccine, what we want to be looking at is in a controlled environment. We want to be looking at a randomized clinical trial where you have a proper control group, ideally placebo controlled, and that you monitor things carefully over the course of the trial so that any observed differences can be attributed to the investigational agent rather than other confounding variables. And so what we decided to do is take a deep dive into the Pfizer data, the Pfizer phase 3 trial. And the reason why we chose the Pfizer data, of course, there's other vaccines that are approved in Canada, is because this is the one that's being approved for adults, for adolescents, and for children in Canada. And it's the one that's used most broadly, at least here in Canada. And so we wanted to make sure that whatever health policies and recommendations were being made by this particular vaccine, that we could ensure that they were rigorously done. And we were assured as Canadians that rigorous scrutiny and that these vaccines had undergone the utmost of scientific review before being approved. And so we just wanted to go take a look at the data that is available and see what might possibly have been guiding these therapies. So in 2021, these agents were the New England Journal of Medicine publication was released, and they described this phase three trial as enrolled about 43,000 people. They declared that it had a 95% efficacy, which sounded fantastic. And at 2 months of data, they were able to report this. And now I just want to say that 2 months of data is a very short amount of time for any type of clinical trial. It doesn't tell you a lot. It's a preliminary look at the data. However, they declared that this was quite effective after 7 days after the second dose. But one of the things that we didn't actually learn was that the relative risk, they talked about relative risk reductions, but they didn't actually talk about the absolute risk reduction. So a relative risk reduction is a metric that compares the performance of two arms, but it doesn't tell you the magnitude of benefit. And the magnitude of benefit is better conveyed with an absolute risk reduction. And that was really only 0.84%, so less than 1%. So although we treated upwards of 40,000 people, you know, less than 1% of those people actually benefited from a reduction in COVID cases. So I think that that's something that most people who were being conveyed this data initially weren't really aware, that there was very few people who actually were benefiting from this treatment. So I'm just going to move forward to the 6 month data, and this is what we're looking at. So again, we talked about the fact that at the 2 month mark, that's very early times, and we're not going to get a really good safety signal. And so we want to wait a little bit more time to get a better safety signal, to take a look at the data, to see if the efficacy is holding up, to see if the safety is holding up. And when they published this particular report in the New England Journal of Medicine, again, the efficacy was reported as 91.3%, and that's a relative risk reduction of 91.3%. So again, a reduction in symptomatic cases sounds great. They reported a 96.7% relative risk reduction in severe disease. So again, that sounded great. However, a couple of the things that were missing were overall illness and specifically death. Now, if we're in a pandemic and our concern is global deaths, you would think that the paper or the research trial that is actually looking at reducing deaths would be looking particularly at severe disease and then particularly at death. But death, in fact, was not one of the main metrics in this particular study. The primary endpoint was just symptomatic cases. And considering that a large majority of people can have COVID-like symptoms and never really get severely sick, probably means that that wasn't the best metric. What I would have loved to see is severe disease, hospitalization, ICU admittance, and death as the primary endpoints. However, this study was not powered to look at those endpoints. So then if we look at the actual outcomes for this trial, again, we talk about the fact that there is, I'm just going to move my thing over there. So we talk about the fact that it had a 91% efficacy and a 96% reduction in severe disease. But one of the things that they don't talk about is the adverse events. And so one of the things that is really important to understand when we're looking at this particular trial is the primary endpoint is clinical symptoms and a positive PCR test. And the adverse events are COVID-like symptoms without a PCR test. Absolutely. So I'm just going to let that drop for you. So the primary endpoint is adverse events, symptoms, plus a positive PCR test. And the safety data, the adverse events are, for the most part, at least in the reactogenicity component, COVID-like symptoms without a PCR test. So we're not actually, when we're giving the vaccine, we actually could very well be inducing COVID-like symptoms, which is why we're actually conducting the trial to eliminate COVID-like symptoms. So let's just take a look at the magnitude of adverse events. We're going to call both adverse events among the two groups. So although here we see that there's a reduction from between 77 and 850 of about net 700 or so reduction in people who have COVID-like symptoms plus a positive PCR test, right, which is a 91% relative risk reduction, benefiting the absolute risk reduction is very low, only 4%. Mm-hmm. For severe cases, there's only a difference in 22 out of 40,000 people, right, who have a reduction in their disease. For a 90 efficacy of 96%, but if you look at the absolute risk change, it's only 0.1%, right? So here we are vaccinating mass amounts of people, And we're really only able, if we give it to 40,000 people, to reduce 22 cases of severe symptomatic PCR positive COVID. Now, that's the benefit. Let's take a look at the adverse events. So these are treatment-related adverse effects. So that means that the investigator of the trial attributed these adverse effects to the treatment, okay? So here in this group here, when we give the vaccine, we were able to reduce by a net 700. But if you actually look here, 5,241 people had adverse effects from this vaccine. This is based on their own data. Now, you're not going to see this in the main publication. What we needed to go is look at the supplements to see the safety data. And the safety data table is on the left here. And so here on the placebo side, it says 1,311 people had treatment-related adverse effects for the placebo, which is to be, it's expected to be lower. But that's 4,000-ish or 3,500 people being given adverse effects, which could very well be COVID-like symptoms. I'm not going to call them COVID symptoms because they don't have COVID based on a PCR test. But that's an increase in adverse effects of 300%, a relative risk increase of 300%. So if we're actually using the metrics evenly, if we're measuring things comparably, because both of them are indeed, for the most part, adverse events and COVID-like symptoms, one with a PCR test, one without a PCR test, you can see that the adverse events caused by the vaccine are higher. The people are sicker in that arm than they are. And that impacts an absolute risk change of 18%. So that's incredibly high compared to the 4% reduction that we've seen with symptomatic cases. Now, of course, I've heard many people say, well, I got COVID again, even though I was vaccinated, but at least I had less severe outcomes. If we actually look at severe adverse effects, which I've defined at the bottom of the slide as events that interfere with daily activity, require medical care, an ER visit, or hospitalization, you can see that there's 262 people who had an adverse event in the vaccine arm versus 150 in the placebo arm, a severe adverse effect. So even though we're reducing severe symptomatic cases of COVID by 22, we're increasing severe adverse effects by more than 100.
Can I ask you something? Like, do you know the placebo? Like, before we started this investigation, I always thought that placebo is really nothing, basically. You know, it's just the, what's the word, the Kochsalzlösung?
Saline.
So that it's just saline and nothing else. But now I understood that, like, with the vaccine, sometimes, or with, like, these trials with vaccines, they have some of the elements, for instance, these aluminium or something like that, is also in the placebo. So do we know what was in the placebo that they used in this trial?
Yeah, I'm not privy to that particular information. Unfortunately, as an independent scientist, we're limited to what they're able to publish in these trials. And so I haven't taken a very close look at this. But I thank you for highlighting the fact that there is a placebo arm. And when we're looking at the adverse effects, it's important to understand that the adverse effects, for instance, here in the severe adverse effects front and the serious adverse effect, these are adverse effects that could be due to the disease. So, for instance, they could be severe COVID-like symptoms because there's groups of people on both sides who actually got COVID, and the adverse effects that they could be reporting could be due to the drug or it could just be due to experiences. So when we're looking at this data, we have to understand that in this group here, although they received a saline solution, many of them actually got COVID, clinical COVID. And so this group here, only 150 of them who actually got COVID, the majority who got COVID, actually had fewer severe adverse effects experiences than the group that actually got the vaccine. Does that make sense?
It doesn't, but it does, yeah.
The outcomes in the vaccine group were worse in terms of severe adverse effects than the group that actually got lots of COVID. You see, this group has higher levels of COVID.
So I have a question too. Do you know whether you get all the data later on, or whether you get only the publication from the sponsor? Do you get the single files? Can you check the single cases they counted? Is it possible? Are they open? Do they have to be opened or are they closed? Are they owned by the company?
Oh, I'm sure that they're proprietary, given all of the difficulties that, you know, the people in the United States are having accessing all of the documentation. I'm sure that they're not wanting to give this out freely. And I personally have not had access to the individual records of the patient, but I do think that as an international community, that we should move to have all of that data released and given to independent scientists for careful scrutiny. Again, our firm was really only able to work with what was available, and we do have lots of questions, and we would have liked to see more access to more of the data. You know, at times we were able to access FDA files and look for more detail or look at the protocols for more detail. But again, you know, even though we're being subjected to mandatory vaccination in Canada, we actually don't have access to all the data that would actually show us that this was actually a sound decision on the part of our regulators. So I'm just going to move on to serious adverse effects. So serious adverse effects in the protocol and the paper were defined as inpatient hospitalization, requires inpatient hospitalization, is life-threatening, results in death, or persistent disability. And so, of course, we know that COVID-19 can be a serious disease and that it can have serious adverse outcomes. And you can see here that there was 116 people in the placebo arm, which is the one that had the most COVID, that had serious adverse effects. However, I would want you to note that there was 127 of them in the vaccine arm, the ones that did have less COVID that actually also had serious adverse effects. So for instance, in our firm, if we were looking for an agent that was able to reduce severe adverse effects, of which many of them are COVID-like symptoms or something along those lines, then we would like to see lower numbers in the vaccine arm for severe adverse effects and serious adverse effects than we would in the actual arm that had COVID-19, which we're trying to, that had more COVID-19 that we're trying to eliminate. And again,
I would like to know whether it's possible to exclude influenza cases with a positive PCR test to COVID.
This is a good question. And I've often asked myself the same question. You know, one of the things that we always like to look for if we're looking for a test is that it's been clinically validated, right? So we want a clinically validated test if we're going to be using as a diagnostic tool in a study that's of this great significance. And unfortunately, I haven't seen any data that shows that it's been clinically validated, that is actually identifying what it says that it's identifying to the exclusion of anything else, that its ability to differentiate between diseases is clear. And so I haven't received the data that would make me confident in that. And when I see this type of thing, I often think, okay, if we have more adverse effects, many of which are COVID-like symptoms in the vaccine arm relative to the placebo arm, then I would begin to question whether the test itself is clinically valid or sensitive enough to be doing the job that we're asking it to do.
I think the administration should insist on a multiplex test in such cases.
Mm-hmm. And I would have liked to see a much more sensitive and clinically validated tool. Or maybe not a tool at all. Let's just look at adverse events. Let's look at symptomology and see which side has more symptoms, which is what we're really kind of starting to look at when we look at unsolicited adverse events in these two categories. Mm-hmm. It's really eliminating the effects of the PCR test and just looking at clinical disease burden and saying which group is sicker. And I would say on the numerical observations here, we don't even need to introduce sophisticated, but if one arm is higher than the other one, then we can all conclude you don't need to have, you know, sophisticated backgrounds and scientists or analysis to know that this isn't heading in the right direction. Yeah, and so then, you know, there was, and I think the other thing too, that was very curious about the way that we approached this was usually if you're looking at preliminary data, which is 2 months in, you would be very careful with what statements you were to say about safety. You could say, in the absence of scrutiny or in the absence of further follow-up, this vaccine may be safe, but we can't make conclusive statements about safety because we were only looking at preliminary data, which was 2 months. Now, here in this study, we're looking at 6 months of data, and clearly, the indicators are that it's not as safe as we expected. And so again, as an international community and as our regulators, I would have wanted to see much more scrutiny, much more caution. We should be exercising the precautionary principle, not when it comes to locking down our societies because we might be afraid that the virus might be spreading, causing distress to all levels of society. But we should be exercising the precautionary principle when we're actually suggesting that we vaccinate everybody based on very early safety data that was very preliminary.
The market allowance was just a provisional market allowance. And so when you do such things, you should, the observation of studies which should follow, or the studies that should follow until you have the real market allowance, should be well defined and should be well formulated. So do you know that the FDA or the German EMA, or the European EMA, what they asked the firms to observe? Do you know the parameters which they defined to have this observational studies have safe results?
Unfortunately, in Canada, we're not privy to the reasons and the rationale and the reasoning and the provisions and the criteria that were set out. I do know just from my observations in Canada that this data, this 6-month data, the only thing that we were told was that there are no new safety signals. That's the cap. You know, that was the one line summary that we were given.
But it is obviously
And interestingly enough, I've seen these types of statements and what they could mean. It's sometimes something that a pharmaceutical company uses to say that there's no new safety signals in the sense that the types of safety adverse events that they were reporting are probably pretty similar. They were COVID-like symptoms in the first study, and then now they're still COVID-like symptoms. But it's a little bit disingenuous whenever we see that the magnitude of adverse effects are what they are in the study, that they would use that. I think that would probably be a misrepresentation of the safety data. But again, whenever they presented the results, it's really important to know that when they're talking about COVID-like symptoms plus a positive PCR test, they call it an endpoint, and they used relative risk reduction, which amplifies the benefit. As you can see, they use relative risk reduction, but the absolute was minus 4% and 0.1%. However, when they're talking about adverse events, they simply look at them as percentages in one column or the other, and that manner makes it seem like it's not too bad. Look at that. 23.9% of people are getting an adverse event versus 6%. Well, that's not too surprising. But whenever you apply the same statistical treatment to both the sides, which you should, because the only difference is a positive PCR test, that's when actually you see the differences and you're able to compare the benefits and risks appropriately. And that's what our group wanted to do, and to show people that if you apply that relative risk reduction, you actually get relative risk increases that are a greater magnitude with the vaccine than you are reductions in actual COVID-19 disease. So just moving on to deaths, this is another shocking piece that our group uncovered. Deaths were reported in the unblinded phase or the blinded phase. So that's before they did crossover. I'm going to talk about what crossover means. But in the blinded phase, in that first 2 months of observation, there were, I just want to pause for a moment and say that the groups of participants in this study were healthy adults with very few comorbidities. And within 2 months of this trial, we had 15 deaths on the vaccine arm and 14 deaths on the placebo arm in a healthy group of people. Now, if a large number of those people are getting COVID-19 and COVID-19 is deadly, then we should expect to see some deaths on the placebo arm. But if this vaccine is preventing COVID-like illness and the severe disease, then we should see fewer deaths, I would expect, even if it's not statistically significant, but at least a numerical drop in deaths on the vaccine arm. However, what we saw in the first 2 months is 15 and 14. So that's a little bit more in the vaccine arm. Now, it's not statistically significant. We don't know whether it's due to the agent or not. However, after unblinding, what happened was the large majority of people on the placebo arm crossed over and were vaccinated. At that point, additional 5 vaccine recipients died. Now, the numbers of vaccine recipients, of course, increased at that point because a large majority crossed over. But again, if this vaccine is doing the job that we're asking it to do, which is to lower morbidity and mortality, then it is odd that we would see an additional 5 deaths after a vaccine received in that group. So meaning that's a total of 20 deaths on the vaccine arm and 14 deaths on the placebo arm. Now, it was really interesting when we're looking at the table on the left, you can see that you have 15 deaths, that's the yellow band, and 14 on the placebo arm. But the 5 additional deaths in the vaccine group were actually buried in the text, so they weren't easily identified. And you can see that we've actually pulled the text out. So 3 participants in the BNT, that's the vaccine group, and 2 in the original placebo group who received the vaccine after unblinding died. So again, this is a way of making it difficult for the average reader, for instance, a clinician or somebody who's a health policy regulator, to actually really register that these were additional vaccine related, potentially, I'm not saying they are vaccine, but they were vaccine recipient deaths. So the other thing too that's really interesting is when you actually look at the types of deaths that are occurring in the 2 groups, we see that there was really only 3 COVID deaths that were even registered in the trial at 2 months. The 6-month report, 1 on the vaccine arm and 2 on the placebo arm. But if we actually look at cardiovascular deaths, and we all know now that pericarditis and myocarditis are concerns, safety concerns relative to the vaccine, if we actually had looked at the data, what we would have seen is that there's 9 cardiovascular deaths in the vaccine arm before blind and during the blinding phase versus 5 in the placebo arm. So that's a significant difference, especially when we're thinking about the population of healthy adults.
And can I ask you, is this like normal that you unblind so quickly? I mean, wouldn't it have better to really just stick with this like 2 groups, the control group, and then like do this for a year or 2?
I'm just going to zip to that particular slide, actually. Here we go. This is the blinding. So I think this is the question that you're asking. The answer is yes. Especially if we need to, and we're very serious about long-term safety, right? So there's no way that we can understand the long-term safety implications of these vaccines after 2 months. So of course we want to continue our controlled phase, our placebo-controlled phase for a number of years in order to be able to observe the long-term safety data. However, one of the things that is often done is if a study is, or if an agent is declared to be effective, it becomes a standard of care. And then they might say something like, it's no longer ethical not to vaccinate. I think that, I'm not really sure what the regulators decided to permit the crossover, but that could have been something. I've seen that in other studies. And therefore, everybody crosses over, and then you no longer ever do placebo-controlled trials because it's no longer ethical not to treat somebody. But I don't feel that 2 months of data using a genetic therapy that is being used in the capacity of a vaccine and being administered to healthy populations around the globe, that we really had sufficient data to make that claim that it was the new standard of care. And yes, you're absolutely right. By crossing over the way that they did erase any potential that we have for long-term safety where we can attribute it to it. Now, I'm not going to ascribe any intentions, but I know that I was part of the pharmaceutical industry for about 10 years. And if you are wanting to minimize your safety outcomes, then crossing over, having your placebo group crossover, is a great way of minimizing any potential risks that might be associated with your drug. And so a risk minimization strategy would be to encourage crossover at an early point. I'm not saying that that's what they did, but I am saying that that would be one of the outcomes that might occur.
You mean like trackability of the risk that's associated with the drug?
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, you erase the possibility of identifying any long-term risks by crossing over. It is no longer, we're no longer able to ascribe causality.
Of course.
Then and they can say that.
Is it possible now? Do you think it could be possible to have a control group of non-vaccinated and to have it so in a retrospective such a that you could find out and have pairs of similar people and then control it to have this group of the non-vaccinated compared with those who take the full vaccinations. Do you know such trials going on?
Again, you know, I'm a purist, and I would have liked to see that question answered in the placebo-controlled trial, and that's where it should have been answered. And I suppose there's designs, lesser designs, that we could employ to try and answer that question. But I think that we should hold our regulators accountable for their decision to allow crossover. And I think that we should make the position that the precautionary principle should be applied. So unless they are able to prove long-term safety within the context of a placebo-controlled trial, then they should have no position to mandate vaccination for anybody.
Yeah.
You know, if they decided to erase potential for long-term, then the burden is on them to redesign a study, to cease vaccination, redesign a study that proves long-term safety, and then show it to us, and then we'll allow them to continue with their vaccination campaigns. So I think that the standard is the precautionary principle. Unless safety is proven, we shouldn't proceed.
I think yes. If they just don't do because they don't want to know such results, and you're a critical scientist, and you would try to find out what really happens. Then you should design some possibility how to find out how big is the damage of those being vaccinated and those who are not vaccinated. I think from a critical perspective, from an alternative perspective, we should try to find out how we could measure the effect, the damage done by vaccinating the people.
Mm-hmm. I just want to emphasize that there is a line that's used very commonly in vaccines, you know, whenever it comes to vaccines and vaccine injuries, and it's association does not infer causation.
That's
right. So what that means is in an observational study, just because there's an association, for instance, I'm vaccinated, you know, 2 days later, you know, my heart, I have a heart attack. They're like, okay, that doesn't mean, you know, you might have had a heart attack otherwise. So the moment we step out of a randomized clinical trial, a placebo-controlled trial, the answer to every single vaccine injury will be association does not mean causation. Now, when we're wanting to identify risk groups for vaccine, you know, calling them high risk groups, association does mean causation. You are at risk. You know, it's not you may be at risk. You are at risk, right? But in the case of safety, you know, or even when we're looking at our observational studies and we're like, oh, we vaccinated the country and, oh, there was a drop in hospitalizations. That's an association. Of course, we're very comfortable ascribing.
There are a lot of confounders possible. Yes.
Yeah.
That's right.
So just to move on to a couple other things, I'm just going to go back a couple slides because I really do want to talk about the groups that were included. In Canada, our regulators are recommending use in people who have natural immunity. And I just want to emphasize that in this particular study, there were no people who had COVID recovered that were allowed in this study. So we actually have no level one evidence of benefit or risk in that group of people. And I think that that's something, at least in the EU, that I understand is being recognized as natural immunity. But in Canada, they don't recognize natural immunity. And I find that actually quite interesting because if you look at the phase one Pfizer trial, it was a randomized clinical trial with neutralizing antibodies as is the indicator, and the control that they used to see if there was sufficient immunity being generated by the vaccine was convalescent plasma, which was people's COVID recovered antibodies. So interestingly enough, even though they acknowledged it and they used it as the basis for their research and development of their vaccine to ensure that it had sufficient immunogenicity, here in the studies, they weren't included. And we have no ability to compare the vaccine to people who have natural immunity. So making any associations like the naturally immune needed or the vaccine is better or worse are not supported by level one evidence. So just another quick thing about endpoints. Again, if we understood the way that we look at safety is we look at it from a mode of action point of view. And so we would look at the fact that the spike protein, when attached with the virus, when working in conjunction with the virus, does cause a lot of the pathogenicity that we see related to COVID-19. And we can predict that type of pathogenicity. And that's usually whenever the virus starts to circulate systemically that we see the severe outcomes with COVID-19. And we could have probably predicted some of them. They could have been clotting, inflammation, cardiac damage, et cetera. And so if we were very serious about the safety of the trial participants and really wanted to understand safety of these vaccines, then what we should have been doing is measuring clinical outcomes, which are those adverse effects and, you know, both positive PCR test and not, as well as subclinical effects of the vaccine recipients. However, this was not done. And I think that for me, what that says is that they weren't very serious, or at least the data that's been provided around safety is not sufficiently robust for us to be ensured that no untoward effects are happening in people who are receiving this vaccine. So that's just a quick aside. And one last thing about the safety, although we talked about those safety data, it's really important to remember that they only measured reactogenicity, which is basically the COVID-like symptoms that were induced either through COVID itself or the vaccine for 7 days after the vaccine was received. So if anything occurred after that, they wouldn't have been captured in the data that I just showed you. Additionally, for severe outcomes, they only looked at those for 1 month. So in Canada, if I had heart problems that were associated with the vaccine, and I took the time to go see my doctor, and then he referred me to a specialist, it might be 1 month to 2 months to 3 months out, and they would no longer be recording that severe outcome. So one of the things that I suspect is that the outcomes, the adverse outcomes that we're actually seeing in this trial are probably underreported, because although for the efficacy endpoint, they monitored COVID-like symptoms throughout, for the adverse events, they're just doing partial monitoring for 7 weeks, 1 month, and for serious ones for 6 months. So all of that to say is that some of the pieces in the puzzle related to safety were probably not up to normal standards, or not up to the standards that we would wanted to see for a mass rollout of the vaccine globally. And one other thing that just to point out is this study did not and cannot make any claims around transmission. So in Canada, we often hear, you know, get your vaccine to protect yourself and the ones you love. And what's assuming there is that it is going to be able to stop transmission. However, transmission was not an endpoint in the study. And the authors of the study even say, you know, we cannot say anything, the limitations, we cannot say anything about whether how this vaccine works in asymptomatic people and whether it can actually stop transmission to unvaccinated persons. So the whole premise of our vaccine campaign has been, you know, to administer it to the healthy in order to prevent transmission to the weakest members of our society, which is what mass vaccination does. And yet this study was never even designed to do that. So we've covered a lot of data. There's a lot more to talk about, but I'm just going to make one last point when it comes to the efficacy of the vaccine in the 6 month report. As you recall, they said that it was 91% effective. However, one of the things that they did was they actually combined the adolescent data in with the adult data when they reported those outcomes. And in the actual discussion, what they talk about is the vaccine efficacy wanes in adults over time. And of course, it could be, you know, as early as 4 months that vaccine efficacy begins to wane. However, in order, you know, interestingly enough, by combining it with the adolescent cohort, that would have boosted up the efficacy of the vaccine. So when they did that combined reporting, they would have gotten that 90% efficacy and have been able to continue to claim that. So again, to a very careful reader, and when our group would see something like this, we would be very concerned that this is falsely boosting outcomes in order to present them as better by combining these two cohorts. And so we've covered off. Oh, so go ahead.
The adolescents group, was that unblinded at the same time?
Yeah, so that's a really great question. Interestingly enough, the study on adolescents was an extension of the primary study, where they only enrolled, so you recall that they studied 40,000 adults in this mm-hmm. trial for adults. Mm-hmm. So the study for children was little more than about 2,000 children, right? So now, of course, we're looking at a group that has very low risk of severe outcomes with COVID-19. So what we'd want to see is much more careful scrutiny in this group. We'd want to see a study, I would expect, that would be twice the size, potentially, of the adult study and conducted for a very long time to make sure that we are covering off the safety. However, this study only had 2,000 children enrolled, but the primary endpoint for this study, interestingly enough, the primary focus, what this study was designed to assess, it was an immunobridging trial, and its primary endpoint was immunogenicity, meaning the ability of the recipient to develop neutralizing antibody titers. So it was a subclinical endpoint to this study, and all that they did was want to make sure that the antibodies that are being produced in the 12 to 15-year-old cohort were comparable, you know, to the antibodies that were produced in a vaccinated group of older people that were 16 to 25 years. So they didn't even have a proper efficacy, clinical efficacy outcome for this trial.
Wow, that's really, that's absolutely shocking. I mean, especially if you think that these are adolescents, and I mean, shouldn't you at least wait until, you know, the end of puberty, or like if they're trying to, when they're trying to have children of their own or something like that? I mean, how do they develop? I mean, this is and basically just like, so that's a month or like a few weeks after the, or 3 months after the shot, that they would check for these antibodies. Is that right?
And again, yeah. And again, because, you know, it's basically, you know, the assessment of neutralizing antibody titers occurs, I believe they take their series of vaccines and they wait 7 days and then they look to see, you know, whether they're developing neutralizing antibody titers. But again, because we crossed over the adult trial, we have no long-term safety data, right? Yeah. And this study did have a placebo arm and a vaccine arm. And again, they enrolled 2,000. I'm just going to show the data here. They enrolled 2,000-ish people, 1,000 in the vaccine arm, in the placebo arm. But this section of the trial, a lot of people don't know, is descriptive statistics. So it wasn't designed to make any conclusions around the clinical efficacy of the vaccine or the clinical safety of the vaccine. Descriptive just means that it's observational. We can't make any conclusions about it. But if we did look at just the observed data, you can see here that there was only a difference of 16 cases, right? So you had to vaccinate 2,000 people to prevent 16 cases, none of which were severe. So that's like trying to prevent cold-like, flu-like symptoms in 16 people. We give a vaccine to 2,000 kids. And that's like, again, the absolute risk change is 2%. And it has no impact on severe outcomes because there are no severe outcomes. However, I'm just going to show you the same treatment of adverse effects data that we did with the adults. Let's just take a look at this. Treatment-related adverse effects, 33 versus 21. That's an increase of 57%. Any severe adverse effects, 7 versus 2. And let's go back to what severe adverse effects are, because we have no severe cases. Severe adverse effects that interferes with daily activity, requires medical care, an ER visit, or hospitalization. This is the data that we're using. 7 versus 2. Relative risk increase of 249%. Absolute risk increase of 0.4%. Any serious adverse effects, 4 versus 1, increased 299%, affecting 0.3%. Now, these are people who have no, very, very little risk of severe adverse effects or serious adverse outcomes from COVID-19. And yet, you don't need to be a sophisticated scientist to see this is heading in the wrong direction at 2 months. Why are we vaccinating without waiting for more long-term data? Why are we allowing these children to be exposed like this? You know, at the time that this vaccine was approved, I have a slide for this, but I'll just speak to it generally. Usually you do animal testing to ensure safety in humans before you use it in humans and before you move on to clinical trials in humans.
Yes.
So what they did for this to expedite development is they actually did the animal studies at the same time as the human studies. So what they did was they skipped that very important step where you prove the safety in animal models before exposing it to human in order. So what they did is they put humans at risk through expediting this. And I'm just going to talk about the types of studies that I would have liked to see. So there's toxicology studies. There were two of those in place before we approved the vaccinations for mass distribution. But the reprotoxicity studies were not complete. And those outcomes, the final outcomes for those studies were not available before we approved this globally. Tetragenicity was not complete, meaning causing birth defects was not complete before mass vaccination rollout. To my knowledge, no oncotoxicity, meaning does it cause cancer, or genotoxicity, does it interfere with the human genome, was available at the time that they were approved. I haven't had a chance to scrutinize all of the animal studies to date, but I am 100% confident that the normal standards of safety review have been compromised at so many levels. I'm concerned that now we're exposing, and nobody would know what the long-term outcomes are in humans. The indicators to me do not look positive. So again, I would say, you know, why are we moving forward with this? This is our future. I don't feel that the safety data, that they've satisfied the precautionary principle and proven safety before use. And
normally you have in the phase two, you have dose finding studies where you find out which dose to give. Do you know about such studies here?
They did do, you know, again, there's so much data that we haven't had a chance to look at it all very carefully. I do know that they reduced the dose for the 5 to 11-year-olds and that they added some medications in order to purportedly reduce cardiac effects. I don't have any data, you know, it wasn't in the actual study. And so this is something that they might have added to the formulation afterwards, which would mean it's untested. You know, one of the things that I do understand, having read through a lot of this study, is that the normal dosing strategies and the pharmacokinetic studies that we would do, it's difficult to apply here because what we're doing is we're administering, mRNA to people. And so there's so many factors. So the mRNA, it's very difficult to know exactly how that translates into production of spike protein in the body. It's susceptible to different people's biological mechanisms. Some people can produce a lot of, spike protein from very little mRNA. Some people's mRNA might not degrade as quickly as others, so then they can continue to produce it. You know, it's very difficult to regulate the actual amount of spike protein that's actually being produced and where it's being distributed and all of that. I do know that looking at the safety data, that it seems to me that a spike protein is being distributed systemically because it is causing similar symptoms to the virus that whenever it's traveling through systemically. And so we know that the spike protein is the pathogenic component of the virus. So if we're seeing similar effects with the vaccine, then one could probably safely assume that it's also having a systemic impact. I'm just going to touch really quickly on myocarditis. This is a known adverse event in young people. There's statistics, I can get into them, but I think we're running out of time. However, under no circumstances should we ever be assuming that myocarditis is mild or short-lived. I know that there's a minimization of risk talk, you know, in Canada, they're saying, oh, you know, it's fleeting or people recover. Once your heart muscle is damaged, what's replaced is not soft contractile muscle. There's implicate, these have long-term implications. And from classic myocarditis, the mortality rate is up to 20% at 6.5 years. So what we're doing is we're exposing our young people to an agent which has an increased risk of heart damage when they're not even at risk of severe outcomes. And so we really need to be thinking, is that a sound risk-benefit exchange, especially knowing that these studies, these vaccines are not able to stop transmission. The studies were not designed to show a stopping transmission. So they can't even help stop the spread of the disease because this vaccine isn't designed to do that and it wasn't even studied to do that. So why are we exposing our young children to this type of a thing? And again, you know, in Ontario, we should have informed consent. And yet our health officials are going around doing promotional campaigns to direct to consumer advertising of the vaccine among children. And even some children, you know, it's said that they don't even need their parents after 12 years of age. They don't even need their parents' permission so that they're, you know, subject to these promotional campaigns without ever understanding the true risks and benefits and long-term implications. You know, as adults, we don't even know what the true long-term implications are, but we do know that some of the short-term outcomes that we're seeing, there is serious disease, adverse events, there is severe adverse events, and myocarditis is confirmed as associated to that, and it is a serious outcome. So again, why are we exposing young people who have no risk of severe outcomes to these agents? So, I'm just going to check in with you to see how much more time we have and if there's any questions you have or is there anything that you'd want me to cover specifically. I think we spend a lot of time on just the details of the studies.
No, you can just go ahead. I think our next guest is not yet here. So I think we're not under time pressure and it's really very important, I think. Yeah. I mean, from what I just understood, so if you say it's like a 20%,
I was going to ask about that. Does it mean exactly? 20% at 6.5 years.
So 6.5 later, they might die from a myocarditis. So meaning someone...
So at 6.5 years, they're 20% more likely to die than somebody who doesn't have myocarditis. So it basically is shortening their lifespan.
The ones who get myocarditis, they will die. 20%. Yeah.
There's an increased risk of them dying.
Yes.
After 6.5 years.
Yes.
Increased risk to in comparison to what to the amount of people who usually die from myocarditis.
So well, there's probably no So relative to somebody who doesn't have myocarditis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that risk factor, having myocarditis, increases your chance of dying.
It has nothing, whether you have a vaccination or not. When you have a myocarditis, this is the risk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It means if you get vaccinated, you have a 20% higher risk of dying after 6.5 years
than those who don't get
vaccinated.
No.
Yeah, this isn't to do with vaccination, this slide here. Mm-hmm. This slide here is designed to convey the point that myocarditis is a serious outcome.
Yeah.
Okay, so in case you have it for whatever reason, like you might have a 20% higher chance of dying 6.5 years later, basically.
And
yes, that's right.
The reason why I wanted to emphasize that is that there are some groups in Ontario where I live that are dismissing myocarditis as not a serious outcome of the vaccine, right? Mm-hmm. So the rates of myocarditis are indeed higher for vaccine recipients, especially when it comes to younger people. And myocarditis is a serious outcome. Mm-hmm. It's a serious injury and we need to take it seriously because the data shows us that it is serious in the sense that it could shorten the lifespan of somebody who actually gets myocarditis. So again, what we want to do is exercise the precautionary principle. If there is a risk, of myocarditis, an increased risk of myocarditis with vaccination, then we shouldn't vaccinate.
Of course not.
Especially if there's no benefit.
I mean, this is so obvious, Deanna. I don't understand why anybody would still be debating whether it makes sense or not to get the shots. It doesn't. It is so obvious. It's right in your face. They're manipulating the data in an obviously fraudulent manner. And if I take this, if I take into consideration what the group of scientists behind and working with Dr. Mike Yeadon has come up with, that they're definitely trying to find lethal doses. I mean, if you take all of this into consideration, immediately, we should all stop this immediately. We can't wait for the politicians who are not our politicians. And the situation seems to be especially bad in Ontario, in Canada. So why don't, well, I guess this is a rhetorical question. People don't react to this because they are not informed. They don't get the information. I know that if there's anybody qualified to talk about mRNA vaccines and techniques, it's Dr. Robert Malone. And he published your presentation on Twitter. And as a result of that, he got a lifelong ban. Now, this,
I felt very bad about that, by the way.
Yeah, but it's not your fault. And we're going to publish this at as well on our website. And they're not going to be able to take us down because these bastards can't get everyone. But the thing is, if you take all of this into consideration, it is so obvious. I mean, it's really right in your face. It's as though they're trying to slap us and trying to tell us, wake up, fight. And that's what we have to do. I mean, what more do we want to wait for? More people to die? What? There's no news. There's nothing that can surprise us anymore. They're trying to kill us. That's the bottom line.
Well, I often, you know, wonder if there's a high degree of malfeasance happening. It's either malfeasance or incompetence. You know, either one of them when it comes to health professionals is a little bit concerning.
Yes. I mean, there's another thing that we have to take into consideration. I always like to talk about the totality of the evidence. You have to see the whole picture, not just parts of it. And another piece of the picture is that the same group of people that owns the pharmaceutical and tech industry through their financial vehicles like BlackRock and Vanguard, the same group of people owns Twitter. Now, any questions? I don't think so.
Yeah. Yes, but I think there is another. There is another thing I always have to remind. It's that group. We know that the pharmaceutical industry was named organized crime many years before by Peter Gutsche and others, and he wrote a book about all those examples, and they were punished, and they had to pay a lot, billions of dollars, because they committed crimes. We know that they commit crimes. And this is one thing. And the doctors knew it too. And the doctors, many doctors were skeptical, and they did not use the pharmaceutics that were advertised. Many of them were critical. But where are those critical doctors now? Where are they?
Well,
where is the discussion?
One of the things that I'm finding a little bit concerning, and I think that you spoke to this just now, is you know, we talked about the importance of the doctor-patient relationship. And one of the beautiful things about that doctor-patient relationship is the doctor, who is very knowledgeable, is committed to the care and to the well-being of their patient. It's like a covenantal relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a financial interaction, hopefully, right? We don't want that to be the case. But because the way that this pandemic has been rolled out, that power to make good choices for the person has now been moved to the public health officials, who have no understanding, no commitment, no relationship to the individual patient. However, in Canada, at least, I don't want to speak for other. So, you know, what you'll do is you'll have these very articulate doctors get on, and they make a pleaful thing like, get vaccinated to protect you and your parents. So it's all your parents or your loved ones, or, you know, get vaccinated so that our hospital systems, you know, that I don't have to work as hard in my hospital, or, you know. So what we're kind of getting is that these almost like these personalities, these medical personalities now are making pleas based on apparently privileged knowledge of, you know, capacities, et cetera. And then people who are watching that, who both have learned to trust their news networks because they used to do investigative reporting and they used to make sure that they had balanced information. So they're assuming that that's still in place. And then they're assuming that these doctors that are on television or in the advertisements or being put up before them are the same people that have that commitment to their well-being. And so it's very difficult because of the means by which whatever group is promoting this, because they're coming through these trusted sources, people for the most part, Canadians, are goodwilled. And, you know, I am so excited and I'm so privileged to be part of the Canadian group. All these people who came together, who wanted to do the right thing, who did their part, who trusted their political leaders, who trusted their healthcare professionals, their public health authorities, and did what it was required. And yet, that trust has been violated. Yeah. And I'd love to just show you a couple things to say that, you know, they were, at least in Canada, telling us that they had our backs and that although they didn't do the proper scrutiny in the trials in the sense of ensuring long-term safety before they administered it to the Canadian public, although they did say it was safe, they didn't do the proper due diligence in terms of safety. They also told us that they were surveying our safety. So, of course, we are all familiar with these passive surveillance systems that monitor safety so that, you know, everybody reports adverse events and then those adverse events are recorded and we have theirs and we have the UK yellow system. And, of course, Canada has its public access system. However, I just want to show you how sensitive those systems are at detecting safety signals and how inappropriate it is to be relying on those in order to ensure the safety of people who are receiving this vaccine. So this is a trial that we just looked at, and there's a reactogenicity component, which is the COVID-like symptoms that occur after you get the vaccine. And those COVID-like symptoms occur in 78% of recipients that get the vaccine. And 5% of those recipients will have severe COVID-like symptoms as a result of that vaccine. Whenever you look at unsolicited, when somebody just tells you, okay, something happened, I have heart palpitations, my menstruation's off, something weird is happening, 30% of people will report some sort of adverse event, 2% of which is severe. So we know when you're carefully monitoring safety that it's some that the true safety issues are between 78% and 30%. This is when you're actively asking people. This is when you don't actively ask them. In the passive surveillance system, which relies on people not getting paid and getting prompted to have to report an adverse event that they don't maybe even know that they should report or they have a knowledge of how to report it, when we don't pay our healthcare practitioners to report it, and when they're screened on the other side, at least here in Canada, to see if they are reasonably vaccine related, so multiple screens, we're recording for the number of people that have been vaccinated at this time in the analysis, adverse event rate of 0.07%. So our regulators look and say, oh, look, there's very few safety issues associated with these vaccines that we're giving everybody. This is fantastic. But this isn't a true measure of safety. This is an insensitive system that is being relied on to report safety. And it would have been very easy to figure out how sensitive the system is by comparing it to the clinical trials that we've just looked at. We knew what the safety problems were. We knew what the rates were. And yet when we were telling Canadians that this vaccine was safe, we didn't tell them that 78% of people who got it would have adverse effects, that those adverse effects would be like getting COVID, they were COVID-like, or that 5% of them would be so severe. These were healthy individuals that we prescribed this to, who might very well not have even been exposed to COVID or may even have had asymptomatic outcomes, asymptomatic disease. So, you know, again, it comes back to this idea of either incompetence or malfeasance. here is myocarditis and pericarditis. You know, we talked about that. So the Moderna shot has been documented as a 1 in 5,000 risk of getting myocarditis. And you know, in Canada, at least, we stopped giving the AstraZeneca shot to adults based on a 1 in 60,000 chance of getting a blood clot. And now we're turning around and we're giving these shots to children at a 1 in 5,000 risk. And we know that the risk increases as you get younger, and we're giving them to 5 to 11-year-olds. Again, I think that if parents actually knew, if they were given true information about the risks and benefits of these vaccines, then they might have a different choice for their children who are at zero risk of severe outcomes from COVID. So I see that your other guest has come on, but let's just, this is one thing that I want to share with your viewers. And again, we're just looking at real world. So we looked at real world safety, where we know that the safety signals are not being captured by the surveillance systems, at least here in Canada. So this is a report that we just finished about vaccine efficacy. It should have been effectiveness, actually, not efficacy here, because we're looking at observational data. But the Omicron has swept through Ontario. And of course, we know that all of these vaccines were designed based on the Wuhan strain, and the Omicron has 32 mutations in the spike protein. And we know that the vaccine is able to evade the Omicron virus. So that's established. The neutralizing activity is very low. It's 41-fold lower based on some of the studies that have been conducted in terms of immunogenicity. But, you know, in this particular plot that we have here, this is the unvaccinated per 100,000. It's a 7-day average, fully vaccinated, partially vaccinated. And you can see here that this is the unvaccinated that have come along here. And then whenever Omicron came, there was a lift. You can see that the partially vaccinated were a little bit lower, and then there was a lift. But what's interesting is here with the fully vaccinated, all of a sudden now you have an increased rate of infection in people who've been fully vaccinated. So this is negative effectiveness. And there's concerns as to why you would be even less able to fight Omicron compared to somebody who was unvaccinated, right? So before, we were looking at studies where we did have efficacy, and then we saw that the adverse events were higher than the efficacy. Well, now with these new strains, that efficacy has been eliminated. It is no longer likely effective. We haven't studied it in a phase 3 clinical trial, but its effectiveness now is much lower. And in fact, we're seeing negative effectiveness. So that is concerning. And I just want to bring your readers to a couple things. This is the Moderna phase 1 trial, and this is the discussion that was in there. And in the Moderna phase 1 trial, it was actually indicated based on animal testing. I'm going to read this to you. It says, based on previous experience with veterinary coronavirus vaccines in animal models of SARS-CoV and MERS-CoV, infection was raised safety concerns about the potential for vaccine-associated enhanced respiratory disease, meaning it makes it worse. The vaccine makes it worse. So we knew this, and that the antibody-dependent enhancement and replication of the vaccine antigens induced antibodies with poor neutralizing activity, meaning that if the vaccine is not able to neutralize the virus, which is the case with Omicron, that this could potentially lead, based on the researchers' conclusions in the vaccine trials that were conducted by industry, it actually says that there could be a chance of vaccine-associated enhanced disease. In addition, on the right-hand side, we have the Pfizer cumulative adverse event report that was acquired through FOIA by a group, and it shows the pharmacovigilance data that the vaccine companies are required to collect. And in their report, they said, we have safety concerns. One important potential concern is vaccine-associated enhanced disease, including vaccine-associated enhanced respiratory disease. So again, these are things that were documented and known and could have been predicted. And now, at least in Canada, we're seeing indicators that we could be seeing this. Now there's, you know, different, you know, we haven't as a group figure out exactly what's causing this. It could be antigenic sin or imprinting. It could be immune exhaustion. There could be a level of tolerance. Whatever it is, again, this is another reason for concern. And if we're our answer to what is happening is more vaccine that doesn't work, that has no neutralizing capabilities. And we know that if you have low neutralizing capabilities, that you could potentially be causing vaccine-associated enhanced disease, then we have to, again, say stop and question how reasonable it is. You know, it may not have been even reasonable to proceed in the first place, but again, even less so now that we're going to be meeting all of these variants and that our original vaccines have less neutralizing capability. And even if we were to create a new vaccine for Omicron, it would come and go and its next, you know, cousin would come and go before we've been able to mass vaccinate everybody. So we're not in a winning game, and we could very well be causing vaccine injury at a serious and severe level. And we could also be compromising the immune systems of the people that we're vaccinating.
That's what the evidence points to. At least that's what some of the experts who we told, who we talked with, said. It is very well possible that the vaccines, the so-called vaccines, seriously damage our immune systems, making it impossible for them to ever again acquire natural immunity for anything.
Right. Which, you know, is deeply concerning.
Yeah.
Is deeply concerning. And, you know, if the pharmaceutical companies were looking for an ongoing profit line whereby they would supply us with the boosters that we need in order to be able to fight the diseases that, you know, naturally occur, it's probably not a reasonable option either, because they would have to be able to predict the variants and all the mutations that have occurred, et cetera.
Yeah.
So again, maybe it might be beneficial if you had a population control line, but in terms of your commitment to the well-being of the international community, which I am committed to, you know, it doesn't seem like a reasonable or wise approach. And you know, we're very quick to exercise the precautionary principle when it comes to mask wearing, even though it's traveling by aerosols. We're very quick to exercise a precautionary principle when it comes to locking down our societies, which have untoward effects. Why aren't we exercising the same precautionary principle when it comes to vaccination?
Yeah,
it's very, very strange. I want to ask you, since you're also working in the field of cancer studies, research, this area, you know, we are getting signals basically from doctors working in especially in the, you know, gynecologists. And they say that the cancers that they see now, I mean, at least they're getting, they have the feeling, you know, they're observing it, that it's growing faster, more aggressively. And so it's maybe also pointing into the direction that the immune system is not coping with the, you know, the cancer cells that are with us anyway all the time, basically, but they, you know, get eaten by our immune system, I mean, most of the time, usually, unless there's something maybe wrong. So do you also get signals like that in Canada?
Again, you know, I can't actually speak to this because, again, we're not collecting the data, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't make claims or careful. I mean, it's very fascinating. We have amazing amounts of money, amazing amounts of care and attention and technology organized to detect any increase in cases, any decrease in cases, any COVID-19 related hospitalization or any COVID-19 related death. We're very good at doing that. It's if I were saying that we had OCD, I would say we have OCD when it comes to COVID-19 events. But unfortunately, we're completely blind to any of the secondary implications of our decision-making, whether they're related to, you know, the vaccines, because we didn't study them appropriately. And there's, you know, because there's been such effective propaganda in Canada, whereby our regulators have said that they're safe and effective, people move forward thinking that they're safe and effective. So for instance, if you had somebody in your family who got cancer or who had heart attack, you know, even when their cancer was controlled, or their heart attack, or they, you know, their heart was in fairly good condition and they were, you know, of my age or so, it would be very difficult for the family to even make the connection that that was related to the vaccine, because it's not in your mindset. You're not being told that that could be a possibility. We haven't studied it. And so it's a way of making it very, very difficult to make that connection. Now, when we look at something like that, what we want to do is, you know, we're continually looking for biological agents that can decelerate or interrupt oncogenic pathways. Oncogenic pathways are pathways that lead to the growth of cancer. And I've looked at some studies, and they're concerning in that the spike protein has been shown, whether it's with COVID-19 or otherwise, free floating circulating, that it can accelerate or enhance these oncogenic pathways. So from a biological or physiological mode of action, it could be plausible that this is having the effect. Another indicator that we know is that the spike protein can cause inflammation, and we know that inflammation is linked to cancer, right? Mm-hmm. So there are many agents that are designed to try and lower inflammation or even decrease anti-angiogenics, for instance, are about, you know, limiting circulation in that regard. So again, it is plausible that it could be affecting cancers. Now, we haven't done the oncogenicity tests and we haven't looked at it very carefully. So again, I would say shame on us for not proving the safety in this regard and for not monitoring it carefully before we administer it to the masses.
Well, I mean, it's a huge propaganda scheme. I mean, obviously, you know, I came across some advertisement a few days ago, and it says like, booster, get the booster shot. It even works if you don't believe in it. I mean, you know, if you see this as like an official by the government, you know, by the government, and you see this like when you walk, wait for your subway or so. I mean, how would you ever think that there's something wrong with this? I think it is so criminal. You know?
Yeah, I think that we should be at the very least very concerned that we're practicing medicine via propaganda. You know, I come from I did 10 years serving in industry, and so I'm familiar with all of the regulation that's in place in order to regulate how pharmaceutical companies are allowed to communicate with the general public. And there's lots of regulations. They need to make sure that they have balanced presentations. They're not allowed, you know, it was only very recently that they were even allowed to do advertisements. But what I find very interesting is that the government, which is usually the regulating body, is now practicing and abusing, you know, they're doing the very thing that they have told the industry that they are not allowed to do.
Well, they're leaving all the regulation to the industry. It is all in private hands now.
Yeah, well, you know, they are perpetrating, you know, if they called it a crime for a pharmaceutical to do it now, you know, they're doing it without any checks. And it's not even supported by data. So, for instance, you made a claim about the boosters. There's not even any randomized clinical trial. And now they're not even going to do trials anymore. All that they're going to do is see if the neutralizing antibody titers go up.
Yeah.
And then we're all going to say that this is now the new measure of effectiveness. So it is a little bit concerning. And if we let them continue, I tell you that they will do whatever they want to us.
Exactly. It is very, very obvious, I think. There is no innocent explanation for this. No more. There's so much evidence. Well, I don't want to get into this again because we're spinning around in circles now. But there is no innocent explanation. We have to take this very, very seriously, and we have to ask the question over and over again: why do we want to expose children who are at absolute, statistically, at no risk whatsoever? Why do we want to expose them to these risks? What is the real reason?
Yeah, especially when the poorly conducted safety trials are already showing more severe and serious events that's not statistically significant on the vaccine arm compared to the one that we're trying to prevent. So you know, good questions. And unfortunately, you know, on our YouTube channel, which is COVID Sense, we did an episode on those oncogenic drivers and how it's potentially, you know, that these vaccines could in fact be promoting cancer, and that this is something that should be researched and we should be very careful looking at that before we continue to give ongoing vaccination, mass vaccination period to children and boosters. You know, I was censored in my YouTube channel. You know, that video was taken down because I was off narrative. So again, you know, very concerning around propaganda, very concerning about, you know, censorship. Thanks to all of you for, you know, giving us this opportunity to share our research with you, to kind of allow your audience to get into the nitty gritty details of these trials. And I'm just really hoping that, you know, it's so wonderful to see the goodwill of Canadians. Yeah. And it's so wonderful, to see how trusting we've been of our health authorities and our government, because we want to do the right thing. However, at some point, you know, it's important to actually start to think and to look at the data, and then to hold those people who may very well have made choices that weren't in the best interest, for whatever reason, of the people, to hold them accountable and to take those rights back.
We have to do
that. But anyways, I just really appreciate the opportunity to share our findings with you.
Well, thank you for sharing these findings with us. Just out of curiosity, in this cool group of Canadian COVID Care Alliance, are there people like Professor Byron Bridle and Dr. Roger Hodgkinson and Charles Hoffe? Are they members of this group, of this team?
Yes, yeah, they're my colleagues, people that I'm privileged to work with on a regular basis. Yes. Very good people. Byron, we're really so thankful for him for uncovering the fact that the lipid nanoparticle actually travel through this system, and they can actually lodge in things like the ovaries, etc. And a big call out to him for alerting us to that, especially as it comes to the vaccination of our kids.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you very much. This was important, and I know that many people who are watching this are shocked once more. There seems to be no end to this, but it is important. This is a kind of a shock therapy, really, which is waking people up all over the world, not just in Canada, as we've heard from our Australian guests. It's happening in Australia as well, because it's all in our faces, especially when you explained this to us. Thank you so much, Deanna.
Oh, it's a pleasure. And I'm confident that, you know, there's such intelligent people in this world and good-willed people and people who are willing to do the right thing, that if we just direct that, you know, and ground it in some evidence, that, you know, I don't think anybody who has conflicting interests that might be trying to push another agenda will have a chance when that's activated. So thank you for your role in that. Thank you for the opportunity to share these outcomes with you. And, you know, please feel free to go to the Canadian COVID Care Alliance website. We were fact checked, and we've got a very scientifically robust response to our fact checkers, just to get a little bit of taste of the caliber of scientists at the Canadian COVID Care Alliance, and a lot of resources for people who are looking for more information. So thank you so much.
We're going to publish this on our website as well, because we want everybody to know this. This is so important. Thank you, Deanna.
Okay. Thanks so much. Well, thank you very much. Take care now.
You too. Have a great weekend.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.